Hello and welcome to the Geek Roulette Podcast. This is one of your hosts, Mike Spriegel.
And this is John Lundquist. How's everybody doing out there today?
See, I think that's the thing, is you always ask how everybody out there is doing.
Yeah, and there's not really anybody here. It's the listening audience.
It's the fourth episode in a row, and I think that's it. I think we isolated a key. Each episode, you sit there and ask who, you know, how everybody out there is doing. They're not going to answer you, John.
Maybe they're talking to their car speaker or whatever it is they're listening on.
Yeah, that's even going to be weirder for them. What, don't make their situation. You're just forcing
them into... I'm doing fine, thanks.
See, don't do that. No, we just went back to the well. You're forcing a horrible, awkward social contract where somebody's like, oh, I'm doing fine. Oh, wait a minute, I'm driving. I don't give a shit.
That's going to be your opening gimmick, is just awkwardness.
No, it isn't. That's it. You're banned from asking how everybody's doing. We do that, then the whole thing goes away.
Yeah, you know.
Anyhow, so starting out for what we're going to be talking about this episode, we're going to be talking about comic books for beginners. And to help kind of extrapolate that is that with the influx of so many now comic book-based movies, not just the total success of Marvel, but even seeing what everybody else is doing. I mean, DC, you're trying. Yeah, keep going. You're going to do it, guy. You're going to do it, DC. You're going to make a good movie someday.
They've had a couple. I've heard good things about Shazam. I haven't seen it yet, but...
Well, they got James Gunn, who can't make Suicide Squad 2 worse, right?
You wouldn't think so, but...
You wouldn't think so, but, I mean, even going into other sort of things, that comics been on the mediums. I mean, AMC had Preacher that was on there, so, I mean, I personally didn't like it too much. I think it kind of went a little against the grain of, I guess, what I was expecting out of it. Another one of Garth Ennis's... stories, Boys, is being sent to Amazon Prime. You've got like The Tick on Amazon, which of course has comic book origins. You have even like Why the Last Man, that's in production right now. So I mean, you got a lot of different comic books that are being put onto the big screen, small screen, streaming screen.
Yeah, and I think kind of what led me to this was it's kind of a postscript on the Avengers episode from a few weeks back. And that you've got a lot of people that watched, you know, the Avengers Endgame and, you know, all the Marvel movies over the past 11 years and kind of went along with it, you know, and followed that continuity and the storyline and all the cool, awesome moments. And it kind of got me thinking that, you know, that's awesome in the movies, but it's also kind of why, like, Mike and myself and a lot of people, that's why we read the comics, is because the comics have that continuity. They have those awesome moments. I mean, a lot of those moments were, you know, like when... You know, and spoilers if you haven't seen Avengers Endgame, like when Cap gets Mjolnir, you know, like I knew that was happening because that's something that happened in the comic books, you know, and it didn't make that moment any less awesome. It was something you could look forward to. So I think that's something we appreciate from the comic books. And I think that comic books do, though, unfortunately, have kind of a barrier to entry where it's, you know, you can only get them kind of in certain specialty shops. I mean, I think digitally now it's kind of opened up a little bit more if you want to get them digitally, but, there's still a lot out there, and you might not know what exactly to look for, what to read, what's good. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there, but unfortunately, there's also a lot of crap out there, too. So, I mean, it's kind of sometimes you might pick up the wrong thing if you're just wading in on your own. And so we're going to kind of help hopefully clear the water on some of that and give some people some ideas if it's not something you've ventured into, or if you have, maybe we'll mention a few things later on that you haven't checked out yet that you'll be looking forward to.
I think the hardest thing about comics is that what makes comics, I think... inaccessible or difficult for people to get into is the long storied histories and past of them. I think especially when you look at Marvel and you look at DC, these are two companies that have been around for almost talking about at least 100 years.
I think we're going on 80 years, I want to say, roughly for both of them, give or take, depending on which one you're looking at.
Right, exactly. I mean, they've been around for so long, they've had so many stories happen, so when you have that much history like DC, they keep trying to reboot their universe to try to make it more simpler and understand. Marvel uses the shifting age range where, you know, when Iron Man first came out, you know, he was being, you know, it was a different war versus the modern version of Iron Man. Now it was the Desert Storm. And
and I think the other barrier to entry is you'll maybe go into a comic shop, so you've gotten past that part and you look at the shelf. I mean, like Action Comics and Detective Comics just passed issue 1,000. So, I mean, you look at the cover and you see something over 1,000. You're like, good Lord. I mean, what am I missing out on? That I don't know, you know, and you don't necessarily know that you don't need to read those previous 1,000 issues to, you know, to know what's going on currently. So, I mean, kind of touching on that barrier of entry, what got you, you know, let's talk about what got us started in comics. Like, what got you going?
So, for me, it's interesting because with comics, my uncle read comics, and anytime I'd visit, he always had, you know, various ones around, both from Marvel and DC, some of you know, classics from the 70s and everything. But really, I didn't start getting into comics myself. it's interesting. My gateway into comics was probably more because of licensed titles. Like when Star Wars had a comic, I got into kind of like started buying Star Wars comics because, hey, this is sweet. I like Star Wars. Here's comics. Same thing with Transformers. Same thing with G.I. Joe. So a lot of my entry point to comics was actually marketing tie-ins with other, you know, bigger franchises and other mediums in that sense. It would eventually then evolve out into other genres of comics, more specifically the superhero genre. But I mean, if I read a comic, you know, there would be times you go to like there was a barbershop I go to, and you know, when I was a kid, and there would always be comics, and I'd read it. There wouldn't be any context, and I think that was always even a harder thing when you're a kid, because you're reading like, all right, here's a comic with a Hulk in it. Like there's one issue of the Hulk, and it's the issue where. It's a really surreal one where he's having kind of almost like this weird dream where he's mauling and killing the Fantastic Four.
Nice.
It's the John Byrne issue, if I'm correct. And I remember reading them, like, I have no idea what's going on. Aren't those guys supposed to be good guys? But you'd read the comic and everything, and it was like issue two. It was in the late, I think, mid to late 200s or so, somewhere around there. So that's the problem right there, is you got like already 200 issues of history beforehand, so you don't understand some of the things in there. Sometimes you would see things that would help you understand, like, all right, I like Spider-Man, but I don't understand some of these things going on. But then, like, Spider-Man would get a cartoon, like Spider-Man and his amazing friends, like, oh, all right, so that's who some of these characters are right here. And my introduction to other like comic book characters like the X-Men came from like Spider-Man and his amazing friends. Like, oh, look, the X-Men, I kind of heard of them, but I don't know who they are. That cartoon helped it kind of explain some of that out. So there was, I think, a lot of gateways. I think for me, my entry into comics started out with other bigger brands, and I think other things like cartoons and other mediums helped me get more into comics when you started understanding some of the other factors involved.
Yeah. For me, I was fairly young, and also, oddly enough, involved my uncles. I'd bring them some kind of trinket, like whenever we'd go to their house, you know, my grandma's house, this was when they were still living out there, and I'd bring them some trinket of some sort, and I'd give them whatever it was, and then they'd take me down to like a 7-Eleven or a drugstore, and be like, okay, here, pick out a comic book. And I remember the three, I distinctly remember getting two of them more than one. I remember there was a Dark Crystal movie adaptation I got at one point. Hawkeye's miniseries, I had picked up an issue of that, which is kind of to this day why Hawkeye is one of my favorite characters. Then, like you had mentioned, there was a Star Wars issue I got. And that was kind of my gateway. And then also, kind of like you had mentioned, the Transformers comics. You know, I remember in grade school, like I think in fourth grade or fifth grade, there was an issue that had like some group shot of all these Transformers kind of lined up, and they had this contest in the back where it was like, if you could name all these Transformers, you could win this prize or whatever it was. And I remember me and you kind of writing down the numbers and being like, okay, this is that guy, this is that guy, and just naming them all off. We sent it in. And we must have done it under my name, because then I got something back where we didn't win the grand prize, but I got like 50% off subscription. So I got two subscriptions that were kind of related to Hawkeye, which I liked. One was Solo Avengers, which was kind of a Hawkeye-based Avengers, almost anthology series. It had two stories kind of in one issue. And then the other was the Hawkeye-led West Coast Avengers team that had Hawkeye and his wife Mockingbird and a rotating cast of other people. And from there, I kind of branched out, you know, like, I mean, G.I. Joe, Transformers, you know, Avengers, you know, you kind of, you know, I'd go down to pick up, like, the Avengers, West Coast Avengers stuff, and I'd see X-Men on there, and there'd be maybe a cover that would kind of catch my eye. Like, I remember, you know, I think it was X-Men 251 at one point, where Wolverine's kind of crucified on this X thing on the cover, and it was just, you know, you got to pick that up and see what's going on there. And then kind of from there, you just kind of end up branching out into the other stuff, you know, Spider-Man, X-Men, you know, the DC stuff came a little bit later for me. I've always been more of a Marvel guy, but that was kind of definitely my gateway, was bringing the stuff to my uncle, then bringing me to the store, and then just kind of from there, see, you know, checking out the licensed stuff and branching out from that.
Yeah, I think one big factor is, you know, what was around you to buy comics. For me, when I was growing up in St. Paul before I met you, there was a comic book shop that wasn't close. It was close and it wasn't. It wasn't close enough for me to walk to, but it was somewhere that I had a friend that used to live like a few blocks from there, and we'd go visit there and buy our Transformer comics from there. And it was called Uncle Sven's Comics off of Grand and I think Fairview, if I'm right.
I'm not sure. It's still there to this day, I'm pretty sure, but I've never actually been there.
Never been there, but yeah, that was where what my original hookup for comics was, and I would go there. I would buy, you know, comics here and there. I think one of the biggest things with comics is this, is that I was at the mercy of, I think, what my parents would buy me. You know, it's like, hey, Mom, can I buy this comic? Well, okay. Or if I got birthday money, maybe I'd go buy a few back issues of comics here and there. I think one of the key things is that, you know, involved change as we got older is that it's money became more available, be it through allowance or be it through other little jobs or chores that you would do. That's where you'd re-divert that money then into getting more comics. And
yeah, I mean, for me, it was almost like, you know, I kind of evolved from I'd go down to the local drugstore and they had that, you know, the classic spinner rack that would have stuff on it. But sometimes, you know, maybe they'd get the next issue in, maybe they wouldn't. I mean, it was certainly not reliable by any means. But I know after a while, for me, I ended up getting a job as a caddy at the local country club. And as luck would have it, like two blocks away from there was a store called Shinders, which around here was a local chain that had comic books and magazines and baseball cards. And of course,
porn.
Yes, of course, that backroom squeaky door porn. So that every time somebody went in there, everybody knew. But I'd go caddy.
Go back there a lot?
No, I never actually, even when I got old enough, I never went in that room.
I did a couple times.
Oh, you poor soul.
I remember I went back there with a friend. I'll leave his name out for his safety and defense and everything. We went back there, and because it's a weird now off topic, but it's like you don't know what's back there, and until you start like going back there, like, holy crap, they have a book about that, and you start realizing, oh, so that's what other people's fetishes are.
Yes, very weird. But, I mean, I'd spend a Saturday morning caddying for 3 or 4 hours, whatever it would take. I'd get my $15-$20. And much to my parents' dismay, I would walk right over to the comic store and I would buy whatever caught my eye, be it, you know, the new Image stuff that was coming out, which was, you know, a thing back in the mid-90s. Definitely lots of Marvel stuff, DC. I mean, you'd kind of go, and when you're, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, you know, having $20, you know, $40 maybe after over the course of a weekend, you know, that's a friggin' gold mine. And I'd go and blow it on comics that, you know, most of which I still have to this day. And, you know, from there kind of evolved, you know, got different tastes. I know I remember for a while I was going to a store called Dinkytown, or not called Dinkytown, it was in Dinkytown called Dreamhaven. And there was one of the guys there that every time I'd come in, he'd have a recommendation. There's a lot of stuff that I, you know, like to this day that he recommended that I pick up and check out. And kind of from there into, you know, to adults, I went to different, you know, would go to different comic stores that were kind of located near wherever I was at. And, you know, to this day I pick up my comics at a local store called Level Up Games, where they pull the comics I want and I grab stuff off the wall. And, you know, that's more or less it for me. How did you evolve in your comic buying habits?
I think it started out just because it was based on limited funds. So after a while, like, I was just getting comics like the X-Men and, you know, just some of the more, you know, mainstream popular ones. It wasn't until I started getting more of an allowance and I started getting more, you know, money. And I think really what changed is when I got a job. When I first got my job, I think the trick is this, is then all of a sudden, like, I'm going from buying like 7-8 comics a month, I was buying like 40-50 comics a month. All of a sudden I was immersing myself not only what was currently out there, but also I was, for me, I know, a bit much bigger proponent of going into back issues and learning about older stuff as well. And you know, I remember like in the early 90s, I think for me, I bought, you know, Marvel that I did buy was mostly just X-Men based Marvel. I wasn't buying much else from there. I found myself getting more into DC because DC had a richer history, and I think some of it a little easier to get into, so I bought a lot of DC. And then there's Image. Image is the hardest duck to quantify at this point because, as comics go, it is some of the most superficial. Let me put it this way. Image in the 90s was some of the most superficial and just shallow comics, full of nothing but some of the worst gimmicks in the world. Eventually, the company has evolved into something where it's a huge, huge, like, independent owner, you know, comic owner.
Yeah, I feel like the turnaround that Image has done from the 90s when they first started out for quite a while, it was not seen as something that was quality stuff. It was mostly art focused. Even that, a lot of it, you know, there was the founding members were really good, but then they kind of each had their own studios, which a lot of which was hit or miss. And I think it kind of got to a point where the quality and there was a timeliness thing too there, where it really declined over after a while. And I think the last 5 or 6 years it's really turned around to where it's kind of that's where you go for good quality creator owned you know, independent comics. Is Image has quite a few. I mean, it seems like every month there's 2 or 3 things coming out that look like they're really good and worth giving a shot to.
Well, I think the other big turnaround with Image is this, is that you it was all proponent based on, let's say, the contributions of a few key anchors. You know, you look at Brian Michael Bendis in his comic Powers, and you think about how that was like a huge driving force and image in the early 2000s. You think about like the mid 2000s, and you had like Robert Kirkman with his contributions of The Walking Dead and Invincible, and how those, like, he showed, hey, you can have an amazing comic and not be under the yoke of one of the big major manufacturers. And I think it really wasn't until probably 2008 or 9 that you started seeing a lot more of one of two different things. You saw a lot of great comics come from Image, and then these writers and artists would go on to the bigger comics. And then years after that, you see people go back to Image because they wanted to create and have their own flexibility of their own characters.
Yes, definitely. I think Image has kind of had phases, and I think this newest phase, I think, is hopefully the one that's here to stay and the one that sticks around, because there's definitely a lot of quality stuff coming out from there. We've kind of touched a little bit on this. I mean, comics as a whole, I mean, I don't think we need to get into their complete history, because there's a lot going on. But I think, I mean, it started out back in the golden age with when DC first launched. You know, superheroes was the main focus, I think, for quite a while. Marvel didn't come along until the 60s in its form that we know it now. It was around for a little while before that, but their superhero stuff, I don't think, started until, 1963, I want to say, was when Fantastic Four came out.
Well, if you're talking, the Silver Age, because, I mean, you had a lot of the Captain America had existed for 20 years prior to that, along with some of the other heroes on there, but then, yeah, it wasn't until, Kirby and Lee basically reinvented comics and brought all of these, previous characters, but then created a whole slew of new characters as well, so...
Yeah, and the 60s, definitely kind of, like Mike had mentioned, the Silver Age was kind of ran through about, the mid-70s or so. You had the introduction of Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, X-Men, Superman, Batman kind of got reinvented from their golden age, from the first introduction. Got into the 70s. 70s is kind of a weird area, I feel like. I think that's generally referred to now as the Bronze Age.
I think the key thing with the 70s in comics is that experimentation... The initial surge and rush of superheroes kind of wore off, but then I think you had both big publishers in DC and Marvel both willing to try different things. Like, you look at some of the stuff that Marvel put out in the 70s, things that they actually had huge success with was cornering the market on horror comics, such as Dracula, Werewolf by Night, Ghost Rider. You had the more mind-tripping comics of Doctor Strange and Silver Surfer and... all of these cosmic-based things. You had over in DC, they then lured over Jack Kirby, and Jack Kirby created the Fourth World, where you had Darkseid and Apocalypse, and you had, all the new gods, and he created a new world there. But the other thing DC did, too, DC wasn't afraid of shying away, what was current relevant social issues. They tackled drug usage. They tackled racism in that period of time. So it was an interesting period where DC, I feel, was a lot more advocating of just being able to speak out about various current topics, where Marvel is like, we're going to hit up the aspects of genres and stories that most people wouldn't be traditionally used to.
Yeah. I think as you got into the 80s were, you definitely had the big independent boom there. There was a lot, it was called the black and white boom, where, people, I think, which was led off by Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was a black and white comic and very different from the cartoon. If you're thinking that it was, very
mature. I think you're almost kind of skipping something else here though, because, Ninja Turtles came out in about 84, 85 or so. But I think you're ignoring also the importance that X-Men and Teen Titans had on, I think, DC.
Yeah, that would have been late Marvel. 70s, early 80s. Yeah. They kind of boomed and kind of brought that whole... They were kind of the first... I wouldn't say the first, because I think JLA and JSA were kind of big, and Avengers a little bit less so. But I think they were kind of the ones that were really the first huge smash hits in Teen Titans and X-Men, with Claremont and Byrne on X-Men. And was it Wolfman and Perez on Teen Titans?
Yep.
And really kind of took off for quite a while. They're kind of competing books. I think they even had a crossover book at one point. It was a one-shot of X-Men and Teen Titans. That was definitely a big thing for quite a while. There's a lot of people, I know it was before my time, but there's a lot of people in generation before us that look fondly at those years of Teen Titans and X-Men of being very formative comic book years. And then, after that, it kind of developed into... Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kicking off this black and white boom of all these just tons of people like, hey, if Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles can do it, you know, there was even one called, was it Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters or something like that.
Yeah, and I think also Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was more also of a commentary as well on where the comics, the mood and atmosphere of comics are going.
Because Frank Miller's Daredevil.
And, well, yeah, Frank Miller's Daredevil, you know, which was very influential. I think in the mid-80s, you had, were definitely a lot more political aspects of comics were coming into range, too. You had Watchmen, you had The Dark Knight Returns, you know.
Yeah, I think those were kind of the culmination of it, where it kind of took this real-world stuff, and then, yeah, you end up with Watchmen and Killing Joke and Dark Knight Returns, which were kind of the seminal of, you know, the peak of, okay, this is mature, this is adult, you know.
Marvel had Squadron comics. Supreme, and...
Yeah, which was another one that kind of riffed on a lot of that. And I think that's kind of almost how the 80s ended, was with that grim and gritty, you know, because Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns were, I think, what, 87, 88, right around there. Killing Joke was right around that same time.
I think the late 80s were interesting in comics because you had 86, 87, you had DC reboot their entire universe with Crisis and then created basically new backstories, but DC kind of found themselves in limbo at that point because until 1994, where DC had the Zero Hour event, nobody knew what actually had happened in the comics and what hadn't happened because they tried recreating everything in new origins and new stories, but then somebody would reference a story which technically, wait a minute, that story never really happened now in this new continuity, so it created a lot of weird paradoxes. Yeah. With Marvel, I think where they spearheaded themselves in terms of comics was that they focused heavily, like their X-Men was their bread and butter. I mean, they were selling so many issues of that. They made them bi-monthly for a long period of time. And I think the one thing that Marvel did better probably than anybody else is creating the big event. They started having a lot of like big annual collaborative events where everybody would be involved. The Evolutionary War, Atlantis Attacks, you'd have...
Yeah, those definitely were a big part, I think, of the late 80s, early 90s. For Marvel, were their big summer events, you know, Inferno, Atlantis Attacks, like you mentioned. You know, the X-Men had a big crossover every year as well with Fall of the Mutants and the Mutant Massacre.
And the other large aspect, too, that I think that comics had in the late 80s as well, too, is that this, of course, leading to the boom of Image, is the creation of Image, is you had all these marquee artists that were just getting all the recognition because of their unique art style. You had Todd McFarlane. You had Eric Larson, who would eventually replace McFarlane on most of his comics until Larson followed him over to Image. You had Jim Lee, Will Spataccio. I mean, you had...
Yeah, Rob Liefeld.
You had all these young artists with these unique, ripping styles. But then I think that's also where the comics, I wouldn't say got more shallow, but it became more... You know,
more superficial, almost like more
right,
more for sure. You know, the art definitely took more of a front seat than the story did. And that was, I think, prevalent mostly at Image when they first started out. But you know, that couldn't help but bleed over into DC and Marvel as well, where the art just kind of was more flashier than it necessarily needed to be. Some of it was definitely good, but there was also a lot of it that was just trying to copy these styles of these, you know, these rock star artists, basically, is what they were. I mean, they were essentially celebrities, you know, like. That people wanted to ape their style, and you know, some of it worked out okay, some of it didn't so much. Like I remember when Greg Capullo, who's a big artist now, you know, he first started out, he was kind of, I wouldn't say he was copying somebody, but he was definitely seen as one of the
McFarlane clones.
Yeah, like a second generation McFarlane clone. He even worked for him for a little while, but now he's kind of come into his own as an artist and, you know, has a great style and great look.
The 90s became, I think, ugly because of one of the best and worst things that happened to comics in the 90s, and I would say that would be the introduction of Wizard Magazine. Wizard Magazine, I think, did a great job being a showcase for a lot of these different artists, all these new stories, and helped get a one huge collective source of what was going on in the comic industry. But it also created a lot of artificial comic speculation as well. Like, hey, these are all the hot comics you got to buy. And everybody would buy up several copies of the same comic because they'll be worth money someday and I'll be able to retire and go to...
Yeah, you ended up with these books that would sell millions of copies, like X-Men number one, which had Jim Lee doing the art on it, which was this hugely anticipated book that sold, you know, had all these different covers, which was kind of a new thing back then and now is fairly common, but sold millions of copies, you know, Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man number one, and that kind of fed into the whole wizard of, you know, okay, these are the hot books, if you want, you know, this is coming out next month, make sure you buy your copies of it, and so these books would sell hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of copies of everybody thinking, okay, I'm going to have this comic and I'm going to sell it and it's going to put me through college, not realizing that, you know, hey, there's millions of copies of these out there, so there's probably not going to be a whole lot of people looking for them in the near future. You know, the reason comics from the 60s, 70s, and sometimes 80s were worth so much was because there weren't that many of them, you know? I mean, back then in the, you know, 50s and 60s and whatnot, kids would kind of read them. They'd beat the heck out of them. They'd draw on them. They'd rip the covers off. They'd fold them up and put them in their back pocket. So finding nice, good copies of them, or sometimes even a copy at all, is what made them rare. You know, there weren't millions of copies of these things floating around like there are today. So,
and I'll tell you what the 90s comics didn't have. They didn't have good writing at all. I mean, it was superficial, giant, like, cheesecake poses if you had female characters, big, super muscular men. I mean, for some people, they say, oh, that's what comics was awesome. No, I mean, if you read those stories, they were just garbage writing for the most part. I don't think comics really became a more written medium, well-written medium, until at least the early 2000s. I think that's...
Yeah, I think the art definitely took a front seat, which made everybody kind of, you know, the focus definitely became on, let's churn out more issues, let's, you know, if people are buying these things, you know, if we can sell a million copies of Spider-Man number one, let's put out another Spider-Man copy comic, maybe we can sell a million of that. And it became a focus more on quantity over quality, and eventually that kind of led to the bust, which was in, what, the late 90s, I want to say, it was when it happened.
Mid to late.
Marvel filed for bankruptcy and almost went out of business. In fact, a lot of what helped pull them out of that was them selling the rights, you know, for movies. For, you know, that's why their characters are kind of spread out across the ways. You know, I mean, up until just recently, you know, Fox had the rights to X-Men and Fantastic Four and a couple others. You know, Sony had the rights and still technically has the rights for Spider-Man. You know, because they had to sell all these rights off to everybody. You know, X-Men went to Fox as well. Right, I mentioned that. You know, they sold these rights and to kind of help them get some money in and to keep them afloat, because they very closely came to just being out of business and we wouldn't have all these movies today. And it's not until recently with Disney gobbling everything up that they're kind of starting to fall back under the same umbrella. But there was definitely a big bust where all these people who were buying all these comics thinking they were going to be worth money just suddenly all left, because they kind of realized, like, hey, I'm not going to make any money on this. So they left, and then, you know, that was left with not many people buying comics at all compared to, you know, the year previous. And so they kind of had to refocus, and it wasn't until, like Mike has said, I think until the early 2000s that they kind of got back to where they were willing to try different things, and the writing kind of became the main focus, and that's kind of what I think brought a lot of people back into Marvel. Like, I remember Ecstatics being one of the things, you know, refocused one of the...
Go even before Ecstatics. I think you're looking at Grant Morrison writing New X-Men as an example, brought a lot of different mind-bending, you know, ideas to a popular franchise and really helped define the X-Men for at least almost two decades after, you know, that, when you consider what he did.
Yeah, I want to say that was right around when... It had been right around 2000. I think that came out shortly after...
2001.
Shortly after the movie came out.
You had the rise of art writers like Brian Michael Bendis, who Daredevil run is, you know, amazing. But he also decided, along with Bill Gemas and Joe Quesada, why don't we go ahead and why don't we create an alternate universe? Our history is too complex in our characters. Let's create the ultimate universe where we have, like, now the modern retellings of a lot of your, you know, current comic book favorites.
Yeah, it would be, it launched with Ultimate Spider-Man. It was basically like, here's Spider-Man. He's got kind of the same origin, you know, but it's more modern. It was also, I feel, kind of the start of a new way of storytelling. Like, I don't know if you want to call it decompressed storytelling, like, whereas the first issue, you know, not a whole lot really happened. Like, Ultimate Spider-Man number one, you know, it wasn't until, like, the very last page he actually used any of his powers, where he was sticking to the ceiling. And it kind of started this whole new way of storytelling that I think was a big hit at the time, but eventually kind of started to fall flat as people were looking for more story and weren't looking for as much of the, the quieter, more, you know, personal moments that kind of got dragged out in some of those storylines. But the Ultimate Universe was definitely a huge hit for quite a while. They did, you know, they did an X-Men, a Fantastic Four, you know, pretty much every character, you know, it was kind of everybody was waiting for the, you know, their favorite characters get launched in the Ultimate Universe and see how their interpretation there went off.
In some ways, too, the current Marvel Universe owes a lot to the Ultimate Universe as well, because the Avengers are really based on the Ultimate Universe version, which were the Ultimates. And you look at, you know, comics basically got saved. Fast forward, you have independent comics, you know, making a huge stride, putting out some great issues and stuff. You know, you come into, like, the past decade, and it's become weird, I think, in the past decade. In the past decade, Marvel has tried so many different new initiatives where some comics have had several number one issues, and DC has struggled to try to find a way to constantly keep writing, rewriting their continuity, where it's like, all right, this is what now is really going on. And
yeah, I think it's kind of interesting to watch because they're kind of both companies are kind of floundering in their own ways, trying to figure out how to make comics work. And I think that's the tricky part is that I don't necessarily think that comics, print comics, and people going to the comic book store every week is necessarily the future of the industry anymore. I think there's a lot to be said for like these other areas that they're exploring. Like DC's done their DC Superhero Girls line, which, you know, has done really well for them. You know, like I know my daughter loves it, and every time we go to the comic store, she looks to see if there's a new book out of that. And you know, Marvel just started, you know, it's not as successful, but they did, I think it's called Marvel Rising, I want to say, which is kind of the same deal, where it's aimed at more, you know, the younger audience and getting them in. I think they're trying to find these different avenues to get new people into comics, but it doesn't necessarily have to involve them buying comics and going to the comic store. You know, I think they're also trying to look at, like, I know one comic title called Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur is one that doesn't do as well in the comic stores, but I know it has a huge following digitally. It does really well there. You might, you know, like, you're like, how is this comic still at number 30 or whatever, you know, but it does really well digitally. And I think the companies are looking at these other avenues of revenue because, you know, comic stores aren't necessarily going to be the future long term.
Well, and I think the other big thing is this, is that, like, one word that gets used a lot in comics, and some people feel it's a bad thing, some people feel it's a great thing, it's diversity. It's introduction of new different characters. Some people get mad because we've seen legacy characters be replaced by different versions of them, and, you know, hey, guess what? There's now a female Thor, and, like, boo, they're only doing this to try to sell comics because the women. I think for the comic industry to thrive, you need to approach everything. Now, some of the, you know, make sure that everybody's a viable audience. It hasn't necessarily worked out the way it has for Marvel. I think the biggest problem that Marvel has really at this point is that they don't have a decent stable of writers. Their artists are fine enough, but their writers, I mean, right now, I would say I was an avid reader of most Marvel, and I stopped once they did the Secret Wars crossover back in 2013 or 14 as it carried over.
Somewhere there.
For 2013, 14, 15, around that range. And since then, it's just been hard to read. It's just not been a fun read because they keep relaunching comics. It's impossible to try to keep track. Wait, which series do I read first at this point? But the writing as well is just not great. I mean, one thing that's happening later this year is one of my favorite writers around that time, before all of that happened, was Jonathan Hickman, and he's coming back to retake over X-Men, which he did amazing work with the Avengers. He's done amazing work with Fantastic Four, and he's had a lot of stuff that he's done on also Image as well, which has been another avenue for him. So I think that's the problem. And with writers, I think the reason why writers don't want to write for Marvel is because if I create a character, then Marvel owns that character and I don't get a dime from it. So I think that's where you see the independent scene thriving, because people want to have the rights to do with what they want with their own creations.
Yeah, and I think to touch on that legacy thing you were talking about earlier is that with people complaining about all these characters coming up, like, you know, the new quote-unquote Iron Man, Riri Williams, is a young black girl who, you know, is technologically minded, and all these people are, like, you know, like, just getting mad at her, mad at, you know, the new Kate Bishop, the new Hawkeye, and the new, you know, Spider-Man, Miles Morales. It's interesting because it's like, you know, comics aren't, you know, these characters aren't necessarily for you. I mean, that's fine that you don't like Miles Morales. Peter Parker's still out there. Then you don't have to touch him. I mean, it's, you know, people up and coming, you know, the newer generations, you know, they're not going to want to read about crusty old Tony Stark, you know, this 40-year-old guy in a comic, you know, they can't relate to that. So I think you have to bring in these other characters, these younger characters that are more diverse to kind of get new readers in, because, I mean, the 40 and 50-year-old white men who are your stereotypical comic book, you know, buyers are not going to be the ones that carry this industry into the future. So I think they have to an extent create these characters to give new readers inroads into these titles in this universe, or it's just, you know, they might as well hang it up now.
And DC's problem is they tried making all their characters dark, edgy, grim, realistic, much like they did in their movies, and now it's just, oh man, nothing worse than a depressing Superman. And
yeah,
oh man, Batman's looking pretty bleak nowadays. And hey, guess what? They killed off a bunch of characters for the sake of just killing off a bunch of characters. And
yeah, I think the thing that comic book companies need to embrace is that they can't be beholden to these old, you know, these people have been reading comics for 30, 40 years. You have to be willing to make changes in them. I was just reading an article the other day that Tom King, who's currently writing Batman, is, you know, he's like, we're going to be making a change in Batman that's going to be basically a generational change. You know, it's going to be changing the character for quite a while to come. And I think those are the kind of changes that comic book companies need to not be afraid to make, because if you keep Batman the same or Spider-Man the same going forward for the next 50 years, people are just going to get bored with him. And like I said, these younger audiences aren't going to care because they're characters they don't know. So I think you have to be willing to make these bold choices with these characters, but at the same time, they have to make sense. They have to be well-written and well-executed, or it's just not going to take with anybody, you know, new fans or old.
It's that horrible balancing act of, hey, you got to sell enough comics to be able to make the comic viable, but then you got to find your audience. But the thing is how do you bring in a new audience to make the comic viable without alienating other aspects of comic? But then the problem is comics have so many people that are self-appointed gatekeepers where, like, well, I'm a real comic fan and you're not a fan if you like this or this or this. And, like, listen, nobody should ever gatekeep anything at this point. Nobody should ever sit there and say, I'm the one who decides who likes comics and who doesn't like comics. Yet there's tons of assholes out there that try to do that and try to regulate what they want. A world where I just want the comics that's the comics I like. Well, that's great. And the comics are probably still there, but you have to understand the comics aren't just for you. They're for everybody. And
yeah, gatekeeping could be a whole nother episode. There's a lot to be said on that topic, but so we've kind of touched, brushed real lightly the history of comics. Why don't we touch a little bit on some of the genres in comics? Do we want to roll this in with our recommendations? Or our recommendations and our list are going to be kind of combined into one once we get into it here. Do we want to wrap that in with different genres in comic books, since I think our recommendations kind of sprawl quite a bit of it?
You know, I'd say this. I mean, people's traditional thought of comic books is this. It's superheroes, but the funny thing is, the origin is that before, like in the 50s, they didn't have just superhero comics. They had horror comics. They had romance comics. They had just comics of just characters doing things. And, you know, now you look at today's comics and there's so many things ranging from mythology to crime to noir to just overall absurd. And
like you said, they tend to have that stereotypical, you know, Captain America, it's superheroes. But I think it's pretty much any genre you can think of. There's, you know, a pretty healthy amount of comic books to go along with it, you know, science fiction, mystery, crime, romance, fantasy, all that stuff. And there's quite a few good examples for each of them. So I think my thing used to be, like, if somebody asked, like, what comic should I get into, my kind of default are like, well, what are some of your favorite movies? What are some of your favorite TV shows? And a lot of that can kind of translate to what, you know, what good comics you might like from there. So, I mean, going from there, what are some recommendations, or should we go into our list now? And
yeah, let's do our arbitrary list, which are top five comics to recommend to, not just if you already read comics, obviously these are probably things you've already read, but if there's people that, you know, hey, I like the Avengers, but, you know, are there comics out there that are, you know, just as interesting or things that are along those lines, this is what I would suggest recommending to people. I mean, number one I would have on my list, if you have somebody that loves Spider-Man and loves the, you know, whole, you know, quirkiness of Tom Holland's Spider-Man, I would say have them read Ultimate Spider-Man. Came out in 2000-2001, ran for roughly in various incarnations about 150 to 175 issues, I think.
Yeah, somewhere right around there.
It's in that ballpark, but it's a modern retelling of, you know, Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man and how he struggles to, you know, maintain his balance of identity and responsibility. But I feel it's one of those comics that's a perfect comic for almost all ages for people to get into to learn about, you know, Spider-Man as a character without going back through the actual Spider-Man comics where there's, like, so much baggage that you have to sift through. So that would be one I'd recommend.
Yeah, and that's definitely a good one. I would go from there. If you're more into, like, science fiction type stuff, one of my big recommendations is Saga, which has been ongoing for quite a while now. I think they're up to 54 issues, and they're on a little bit of a hiatus, so now would be a perfect time to catch up. It's, without giving away too much, and I'm not completely current on it, it's basically, there's two characters, a guy and a gal, that are from opposite sides of a warring faction. They fall in love and have a kid, and it kind of goes from there. I mean, you get all these crazy, insane science fiction kind of concepts, all this, you know, very big space opera type stuff going on, but also very personal moments happening in there. There's a lot of insane characters you get to. It is also one that if you are squeamish at all about, like, language, violence, sex, that sort of thing, you might want to stay away from it, because it definitely does not shy away from any of that. However, if that's not something that bothers you at all, it is an excellent read. I need to finish up and catch up on that. I think they're supposed to go for another 50 issues or so. But they, like I said, they are currently on a hiatus. But that is an excellent science fiction comic. People kind of, that's one that people are waiting for them to kind of adapt into, like, either a TV show or a movie series. And I think one thing maybe holding back from that is just that it's so sprawling and big, and the budget on that would need to be just kind of insane. So we'll see if that ever happens. But Saga is definitely one you should check out, written by Brian K. Vaughan, and art by Fiona Staples, and that is an excellent one you should check out.
Hey, you may think Spider-Man's cool and everything, but it seems a little juvenile. What if I wanted more of a older, more mature version of, I guess, Spider-Man? May I recommend to you Robert Kirkman's Invincible, which takes a lot of beats and cues from Spider-Man. It's basically about a teenager whose dad is a well-known superhero, and he eventually finds out in high school that he has powers. But as the series goes on, he finds everything's not as easy as you think it is to be a superhero. And it's interesting because Invincible, it ran for about 140-some issues, if I remember correctly. And it deals with some of the common comic book tropes and makes light of some of them in some ways, but still has an amazingly compelling story. Very violent and graphic, various points of the comic itself. But it is actually a great journey of showing how a teenager with superpowers has grown to become a man, you know, his own superhero himself. So I would recommend that.
Invincible is pretty good stuff. I'm not current on it either, but I've read quite a bit of it. It's good stuff. I'm going to go with my next one being probably a fairly obvious one. If you watch Walking Dead or used to like watch it like I did, the comic book is also very good on that one. In a lot of ways, some ways better than the TV show, in some ways not so much. And I think the thing with that is that if you have watched the TV show, I think that it doesn't follow the comic closely enough that you're going to know exactly what's happening. So if you watch the TV show and you're thinking, well, why would I read the comics? It's going to be the exact same thing. I think one thing they did nicely with the TV show was that if you saw the comic book as a straight line, like the plot of the comic was a straight line, the TV show would maybe follow that straight line for a little bit, but then it would swerve kind of left and do its own thing for a while and come back to that line for a little bit and then swerve to the right a bit, and it would kind of take these twists and turns that the comic book didn't take, in some ways for better, some ways for worse. But as somebody who had read the comic books, that was something I kind of appreciated about the show, was that even though I kind of knew some of the big beats that might be happening, they would take a lot of those and twist them in different ways. So then the Walking Dead comic, and it's on what issue 192 now? So I mean, there's a lot that's out there.
No, but not one. It's not 190.
It's up. Maybe it's not 190, but it's up there.
The latest issue comes out today. No, tomorrow. And there's speculation on a huge thing happening. Yes. I'm not going
to
spoil
it. But no. But definitely worth checking out. There's a lot there to catch up on. And also one thing that's worth noting, too, a lot of like Image and some of DC's trade paperbacks, like the first volumes of those are like only $10, which is very affordable. So if it's something you want to check out, like the first volume of Walking Dead is $10, and you can go check it out and see if it's something you like. The rest of them, I think it's like $15 after that, you know, which is still well worth the money that you're going to spend on it and the enjoyment you'll get out of it. I mean, Walking Dead's got a lot of stuff going on and some good stuff there. So that is mine for my next one. What's your next?
For my next one, say, do you have young kids and you want to get them into comics? Well, maybe you're not sure if Spider-Man's going to be the right gateway or entryway into it, and you definitely don't want to show him Invincible because that's going to be far too graphic. I would strongly recommend the comic from Jeff Smith called Bone. It's kind of a fantasy element about three characters that are from Boneville, and it's not dirty. And if you've read Bone, you know how amazing it is. But they wander their way into, you know, this, you know, classic, quaint, so I don't even want to say medieval. I mean, what do you say, middle age style?
Yeah, it's not quite medieval, but it's not quite modern. It's its own quaint little valley where, you know, the characters have kind of a more rustic way of living, you know, and farms and huts and villages and whatnot.
And, you know, these characters don't realize that they're actually part of a bigger plan and picture involving more ancient evils and good, you know, forces of good. And
yeah, I think one thing Bone does really well is it starts out, it seems like it's this very small, insular storyline with, you know, not much going on, where it's just kind of this group of characters. But I think as the series goes on, it kind of slowly expands, and you realize that there's a lot more going on than you've originally realized. And there's a lot going on there that helps that show. I'm losing my train of thought. So, yes, Bone is good stuff. Let's forget about my stumble.
Yep.
My next one I've got is also a little bit more, it's kind of a humor thing. There's a creator called Evan Dorkin, who he's done a lot of stuff. Some of you may have even seen before, because him and his wife have done a lot of stuff in like the animated realm. There's a couple things. He does a lot of more humor stuff. He does some more serious stuff. I'm going to recommend the humor things. There's two of them you might check out. One is called Milk and Cheese, and the other one is called Dork. There's a couple collected volumes of those, and the thing with those, they're just hilarious stuff. They're also the kind of things that you're not necessarily going to sit there and read the entire volume of Milk and Cheese all at once. You'll read maybe two or three strips, and the same with Dork. You'll laugh your ass off. It's very clever, very witty. In Dork itself, there's a lot of different styles going on there. There's a lot of different things happening there. Milk and Cheese is kind of like a one-page gag strip that has a lot of different styles and a lot of different things going on, and it's hilarious stuff. It's also a little avant-garde, but it's funny stuff, but it's also, you know, kind of something you can read a little bit of, put it down, come back to the next day, and it's good stuff, and maybe that'll lead you into some of his other more serious stuff, like Beast of Burden, which is about some animals, some dogs and cats that kind of handle supernatural threats that happen in their city. And so yeah, Evan Dorkin has some good stuff. Milk and Cheese and Dork are the two good ones there.
I would say my next recommendation, if you want something that's great, I would say crime noir style comic, I would strongly recommend 100 Bullets. With 100 Bullets, it starts off as a simple singular premise of what if you were given a gun and 100 bullets, then you could do whatever you want with them, and would you right the wrongs that have happened to you? And then it spawns its way off into being part of a larger conspiracy where we learn about an organization that controls much of the world's interest and how various members and pieces and pawns of it and how all their lives intersect with each other as everyone's trying to come out on top. It ran for 100 issues, which, of course, there's 100 bullets itself, but definitely an amazing overall story. I'm kind of amazed it's never been truly approached to be made for a television series. It wouldn't require much special effects, if anything at all, but it's definitely a very gripping story.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that one. That one's going to be one of my recommendations as well. It starts out with kind of these separate, almost anthology-style multi-part stories that you don't think are connected at all, but then at some point, not too far down the line, you find out that they're all actually connected and grows in this big conspiracy. I mean, the art's amazing. The writing's really well, and yeah, I'm kind of surprised it hasn't been adapted. Like, I think it lends itself really well to a TV series that could go for quite a few seasons, so I'm kind of wondering, it's kind of bewildering why that hasn't gotten picked up yet. My next one has gotten picked up for, I can't remember if it's a TV series or a movie. I think it would lend better for a TV series, and that is Why the Last Man.
TV series.
Yes, and that is basically, it's a story about something happens on Earth where everybody with a Y chromosome is killed, except for one guy named Yorick and his monkey called, what's his monkey named again?
Ampersand.
Yes, Ampersand the monkey are the only two male creatures that live on the entire planet. So it's obviously turns into this huge crisis. People eventually slowly find out that, hey, this one guy survives. So there's kind of all these power struggles to get them under control, him in their control. And it's kind of his journey. He decides to set out and find his girlfriend, Beth, if I'm not mistaken, is her name.
Yep.
And it's kind of him and a small band of people kind of going across country for him to reunite with her. And obviously along the way, they run into all these problems. And things happen along the way. It's an excellent series. I think it went for roughly 75 issues, so it's not that terribly long. It's a great read. Lots of twists and turns, very emotional at times. Good stuff, great art, and great writing. I believe that's another Brian K. Vaughan joint with Fiona. What is her name? Pia Guerra did the art in that one. So yes, Why the Last Man. Look for that one and keep an eye out for a TV show, hopefully, from that one pretty soon.
And for my last recommendation now, this one, I think people like familiarity, and for familiarity, it was ironic because at one point they almost did make this into a TV show, and instead ABC didn't want to purchase the rights for it, so they kind of did their own thing, and they made the thing called Once Upon a Time, but it was originally going to be based on the comic book series called Fables, where it's about all of these different, you know, nursery rhymes, nursery tales, fables, all like, you know, the characters that books we read growing up, like Jack and Jill and the Big Bad Wolf and Red Riding Hood and Snow White and Cinderella. What if they were all inhabitants of various magical worlds where all their stories were realities? But then a conquering emperor came and decided to take over their worlds. So they all fled to Earth and to our reality itself, and how they hide themselves from their existence from everybody else, while all still trying to find a way to overtake the Emperor and go back home. It's ran for 150 issues. This is what I'm going to say, is that it's an amazing read and an excellent reimagining of a lot of our characters that we thought we knew and loved. Some of it takes some of the elements from your Grimm fairy tales. Some takes elements from other more popular versions of it. But nonetheless, I feel that the first 75 issues of this 150-issue series are tremendous. I think they do such an amazing job of, you know, when you find out who the Emperor and who the bad guy really is, and when you find out, you know, what they do to try to fight to get back their lands. The second 75 issues, it's a little bit more rudderless. There are good moments and peaks and valleys in there, but I also feel there's a little bit more filler in there, and I feel when they got to the end of the story, it felt a little bit rushed in some ways.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That was also going to be one of my recommendations. I feel that they almost should have, when they kind of got to that end of that 75 where they revealed who the big bad was. There was a big war there. I feel like they kind of sort of wrapped it up then, but instead they kind of introduced something else and went in a few different directions. And like you said, it was a little bit rudderless, and I feel like they kind of should have just wrapped it up there, and it would have been, I think, looked back at a lot more fondly than it is now. That was all I had for recommendations. Is there anything else you wanted to get out?
No, I think that covers a lot of it. I mean, as episodes go, this episode definitely more of a retelling of the history of comics, and just kind of also just trying to encourage, like, if you love comics and you love, you know, all of these new TV-based and movie-based mediums of comics, you have people that love the same thing. I mean, here's the thing I have to understand. I mean, the Avengers Endgame's done, like, well over billions and billions and billions of dollars right there. These are people that would possibly love other avenues of, you know, comics that have been brought to the big screen. So if you know people like that, hey, you know what? Why don't you go ahead and start reading this? I often seem to plug this a lot on this podcast, but I can't strongly enough recommend making sure that you sign up for Marvel Unlimited. I mean, $70 a year. You can read so many different Marvel stories, and like a lot of the things I recommend, like Ultimate Spider-Man, you'll find on there. You'll find just all of these old comics, and a lot of times they have recommendations based on storylines too, and you can read a certain storyline. If you find yourself interested in that, you can go read the backstories of a lot of these characters.
Yeah, and you hit Ultimate Spider-Man, I think, was the only mainstream superhero title we kind of hit on. But there's a lot of stuff out there that's great. You know, Infinity Gauntlet, which is kind of the basis for Infinity War and Endgame, is a great series. You know, I mean, Batman The Dark Knight Returns, which we talked about earlier, is a great series. Watchmen, there's a lot of superhero-based stuff that's out there that's really great and worth looking into. And yes, Marvel Unlimited is a great way to get that. If you need to know where to find the stuff, I mean, Amazon obviously is going to have all the trade paperbacks. Otherwise, don't be afraid to go to your local comic store and,
or even more, go to a library. You'll find libraries have a lot of trade paperbacks of these comic books, especially some of the more well-known ones. So, and a lot of libraries, if your library doesn't have it, you'll find that, you know, your other libraries can transfer in. I mean, it's free. I mean, you take advantage of the service.
Yeah, and I know also digitally, there's Comixology is one where you can buy them on. I think they also have a lot of Volume 1 trade paperbacks and like Marvel and DC stuff mostly that are free to read the first volume, and then, you know, it's kind of like your first taste is free and you've got to buy the rest. But I mean, that's a good way to get a sample of some stuff and find out if you do like it, and, you know, you can kind of follow it up there if you choose to or not.
And everybody can find a legal website. You can illegally download all of these comics using very illicit ways of doing so, such as BitTorrent, but we never endorse any such things like that whatsoever, because that right there is evil and takes revenue away from people that need all this money for their stuff. So
wait, what was that? I didn't catch all that. There was some weird static there for a minute. I didn't quite catch any of that, but
I don't know.
Yeah. So I think that's all we've got for that.
Yep. Follow us on Facebook at Geek Roulette's Facebook page, as well as at Geek Roulette on Twitter. We'll definitely catch you guys next time. Thank you for listening.
Have a good one, everybody.